Case 55 in the Blue Cliff Record, Dao Wu's Condolence Call, The Pointer by Yuan Wu. Secure and intimate with the whole of reality, one obtains realization right here. In contact with the flow, able to turn things around, one assumes responsibility directly. As for cutting off confusion in the light of a stone-struck spark or a flash of lightning, or towering up like a mile-high wall where one occupies the tiger's head and takes the tiger's tail, this I leave aside for the moment. Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path? Or not. To test, I cite this look for the case. Dao Wu and Qian Yuan went to a house to make a condolence call. Qian Yuan hit the coffin and said, "Alive or dead?" Dao Wu said, "I won't say alive. And I won't say dead." Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" Wu said, "I won't say." Halfway back, as they were returning, Yuan said, "Tell me right away, teacher. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you." Wu said, "You may hit me, but I won't say." Yuan then hit him. Later, Dao Wu passed on. Yuan went to Shi Shuang and brought up the foregoing story. Shuang said, "I won't say alive, and I won't say dead." Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" Shuang said, "I won't say. I won't say." At these words, Yuan had an insight. One day, Yuan took a hoe into the teaching hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east. Shuang said, "What are you doing?" Yuan said, "I'm looking for relics of our late master." Shuang said, "Vast waves spread far and wide. Foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of our late master are you looking for?" And Shui Do added the following comment, "Heavens, heavens." Yuan said, "This is just where I should apply effort." Fu of Taiyuan said, "The late master's relics are still present." So David and I chose this koan for our Columbus Day weekend session, the one where we go out in the boat and we don't know where we'll land. And there's a memory I have. I think it was David who once quoted somebody else as saying that life is like heading out in a boat that you know is going to sink. There is no one of us who isn't touched by this question of life and death. A number of the texts and the poems and the sutras that we chanted this morning spoke of this understanding, this cutting through life and death. And I was particularly struck this morning by our chant that is the dedication where we name all those who are in distress, people who have recently died. We hold them in our hearts for a few moments and we say that everyone passes from dark to dark. This passing is something that most of us ignore or overindulge in agonizing about. But it's a fact on the ground. There's no way to avoid it. Everyone we love, we're of the nature to grow old. We're of the nature to be ill and die. And everyone we love will be separated from us. There are no loopholes in this contract. So part of the work of Zen, the joy of Zen in a way, the great teaching of this way that we've all decided, at least for this weekend, maybe come Monday afternoon we'll say never again, but I don't know. I keep saying that and then I think, no, this is great. I want to keep doing this. And now all these years later, here I am. The question of life and death continually arises. It's not something that, for me at least, has ever completely, 100% gone away. And this transcending of life and death, this understanding of alive or dead, I want to warn everyone that this training is not about coming to terms with this intellectually and saying, oh yeah, right, I get it, everybody dies, okay, what's on TV? It's not something that we get and transcend and turn into Zen robots, where we say, I have transcended life and death, I am beyond it. What's on TV? There's a going in and going out, a going in and going out of the touching of the heart, the great wrenching of the heart in facing this. Our job is not to transcend and ignore. Our job is not to transcend and say we're beyond it. Our job is to transcend it so fully that the heart becomes even more tender. There's a line in Yuan Wu's commentary. He was one of the collectors of this Blue Cliff record, where he is pointing to the central piece of this koan, where the teacher and the student, Dao Wu is the teacher here and Qian Yuan is the student, are engaged in this question. Please tell me, if you remember in the koan, he says, why won't you say? All I'm asking is for you to explain the mystery of life and death to me. Why won't you just tell me? And Yuan Wu keeps saying, I won't say. Yuan's first question is, tell me right away. And if you don't tell me, I will hit you. This is we have to look at his state of mind and not to get into telling stories about our own brushes with death, because that's interesting, but it's really about right now, when you hear this story and all of the deaths that you've encountered in your life already, not even for some of us, too many decades have passed, and already we've been parted from those we love. It just happens, not in the form always of physical death, but in the form of breakups and leavings and partings of all kinds. This desperate quality that our hero, really, Dao Wu, has. I'm sorry, the other guy, I guess. What's his name? Qian Yuan. That Qian Yuan has his great desperation. He and his teacher have made a condolence call, according to Sekita's comments on this, a teacher who also has commentaries on this collection. He says, in those days in China, Zen Buddhist teachers didn't do funerals, but they would go and visit families afterwards and sit in sympathy with the bereaved families. So they're coming back from a condolence call, and this must be generating all kinds of upset, all kinds of quivering and difficulty in our hero's heart. And he asks his teacher to come down on one side or the other to solve this great mystery for him, and to tell me right now, and if you don't, I'm going to hit you. That's how desperate I am to know. I wonder how many of us have felt that desperation. I know for myself, I've felt it many, many times throughout my life. My first encounters with death when my grandmother died, and my then when later when my father died, when my mother died, when friends died, sudden deaths, long lingering deaths. And my recollection of all of those deaths is that every single one was unique and different. My feeling about them was unique and different. But the one thing that was the same was that I didn't get it. How could it be that I was living in a world where things were a certain way and then they weren't? How could that be? And for often, if it was a sudden death, for days afterwards, weeks, months, in some cases years, I just didn't get it. And I wandered around in a kind of a haunted, dreamlike state where nothing made sense anymore. I just couldn't integrate the news. I couldn't integrate this shift in reality. And all the losses, and I really emphasize not just deaths, but separations of all kinds have this effect on us. I was talking with a Sangha member the other day who is a nurse at a hospice. And I used to work at a hospice helping bereaved families. And I asked her, why do you like working at a hospice? She said, I love it. I love working at the hospice. And I said, what do you like about it? Waiting, hoping, really, that she would say the thing that I liked about it. She said, oh, when I'm with those families, when I'm with those people, I don't have to pretend. Everything is right here. Just like during Zazen. Just like when I practiced with the Sangha. And I said, yes, me too. That's how it was for me. No more pretending. Everything right here. So Dao Wu is not pretending at all when he says, I won't say. To say anything, of course, would be wrong, because when we talk about things, we always come down on one side or the other. And there are many koans like this where we're asked to compare things. Two monks roll up the blinds and people raising fists. And if you're familiar with koans, you know that a lot of these things are part of almost the testing quality. Are you going to fall for it this time? Are you going to say, that one, he rolled up the blinds better, I just know it. Or are you really going to come to this place that Dao Wu lived in where you can't compare? You can't say. There's no saying. There's some translations that say, I can't say, but I have to say that I prefer, I won't say. I won't do it. Even if you hit me, this teacher is saying, even if you hit me, I won't reassure you. I won't pat you on the head and say, oh, don't worry, it's not a big deal. I won't say, forget about it, go do something fun. I won't dishonor the reality of separation that's part of human life by telling you anything, so go ahead and hit me. And the commentary says at this point, this can be called Wu, meeting an error with an error. His heart bared entirely. I'll read that comment again because I think the whole koan turns around it. This can be called Wu, meeting an error with an error. His heart bared entirely. This is what we are engaged in here, in this work of Zazen, in this work of learning to live fully with life as it is, our hearts bared entirely. Please don't misunderstand. This is not about feeling sorry for ourselves, weeping and moaning and crying, although there is a time for that, as we know. Sometimes the bared heart is so full and so twisted in pain that the only response is to weep and weep and weep. I remember when I used to work as a grief counselor, and people would say to me, I'm so afraid of beginning to cry because I don't think it will ever end. And in that moment, I would reassure them. I was trained to reassure them. But it also came out of my own experience on the cushion when I've just started to open up for no reason that I can fathom, just wrenching sobs coming out, maybe just because I'm human and this being human is so challenging. They always stop. The tears always stop. I think of Emily Dickinson's lines about the hour of gold and the hour of lead, the time when everything just it becomes a formal feeling after great grief, that formal feeling. This is a moment that we can rely on when the wrenching of the heart, the bearing of the heart is spent. And then it gets loaded again, because if we live a life of being really alive, then our hearts are touched over and over and over, again and again and again. We experience the truth of separation. And this truth that I'm speaking of, please remember too, is only one side of it. I should have just said, I won't say, and ended the Taisho right there. Because the other side is that when our heart is tender like this, when our heart is open, then finding a tiny leaf on the stairway is enough to create in us or stimulate in us the reminder that life and death are always present in every moment. This is not a logical, philosophical recognition. It's an opening to something that is beyond words, beyond saying anything. And the little leaf on the stairway is enough to completely dissolve us into sadness, into happiness, into joy, into sorrow. I won't say, but something open. And then this opened quality is how we get to live. Open to joy and open to sorrow when it comes. Open to all matter of things that come and go and come and go and come and go. Open to our great fears and our great happinesses, our great angers and our great love. All of it touching the bared open heart. So I'll just end by reading Yuan Wu's pointer once again, the beginning of the koan and not the koan itself. Secure and intimate with the whole of reality, one obtains realization right here. In contact with the flow, able to turn things around, one assumes responsibility directly. As for cutting off confusion and the light of a stone-struck spark or a flash of lightning or towering up like a mile-high wall where one occupies the tiger's head and takes the tiger's tail, this I leave aside for the moment. Is there a way to help people by letting out a continuous path or not? Well, you know what I would say. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and people on the far side of the fireplace near the altar, if you want to come a little bit closer in, and if you want to face this direction, you're welcome to do that as well. We're going to have our Dharma dialogue. Anything that is arising for you in this moment that seems true or is a question that is present for you, comment about the koan, the talk, or just anything that's arising.
Thank you.
Thank you for this talk. This week, a friend of my daughter's OD'd on heroin. And my daughter, who doesn't call me too much, she's 25 years old, she called me every single day saying, why did Sophie die? How could I have helped her? And I felt horrible. I couldn't say to her, Sophie's in heaven. I couldn't even say, Sophie, I'll come back in another life. And listening to this talk made me realize how, in some ways, how harsh Zen is, and also how kind it just is. And there was no way for me to soften that. And my heart ached for Sophie and for my daughter, but there wasn't any way to soften it. In a similar way to have my daughter saying, oh, how could I help Sophie? Oh, weak at me, how can I help my daughter? And this talk made me understand I really couldn't. So, thank you.
Just flipping this over for a moment. It's very easy for me, especially even right at this moment, the way I'm feeling, to see everything as dark, to see everything as the sinking, so that the sinking is everything, and the passage of the ship is what's the point, or worthless, or dead, or I won't say dead, I won't say alive. And to, right before I came here, right before I came to this session, I was playing piano in a bar. It's an unusual thing to be doing, but timing was tight, and I made it here. And for the first, I was very, very sad and anxious. I usually don't feel that way late in the day, but I was. And I just played really sad songs on the piano, and there was no one there. And then, after 20 minutes, two people who were very close to me came in. And then another two people who were very close to me came in. And then another two people were very close to me, but who I know for 35 years, but I see only very, very rarely. They live in Connecticut. They were on their way to the Cape to decide stuff. Were there. So I had all these people who truly loved me show up. And I found how difficult it was to unblock my nervous system, unblock my heart, and allow that medicine, and allow that healing, and that gratitude for just right now, and stop worrying about all the other things you could be worrying about, including the ship sinking, including what's going to happen, or what did happen that I should have avoided. But just let the world in. Here is the world presenting itself to me. I have to be able to let it in. It's like you said about just seeing the leaf on the staircase. Without painting everything over, in Pollyanna colors. There's still something to be said for not going to the other extreme. I have to allow the healing that is available in the trees out the window or looking at your face right now. I have to have a way to allow that to heal me. I think. I don't think I'm fooling myself. I do.
Thank you, Matt.
It's so hard to not say. Our mind wants to say, mm-hmm. Even if it's on the dark side. Mm-hmm. Well, at least it's clear. Mm-hmm. But to do nothing when a friend, a daughter calls and says, why? to do nothing, actively be present. Our stories carry us away. We worship our stories, and to be, of course, carried away by them, and to keep coming back. To keep coming to this place of not this and not that, but something more. Paul.
So this little leaf. I like that. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I, we were driving back from Vermont, and we were having this conversation about how amazing the leaves are this year. The maples are just so red this year. And we're talking back and forth. It was very comfortable and loose, as you know, husband and wife can be, and we're just really absorbed as far as with these leaves. And then it started to, the conversation started to come to an end, and the last line was, Bridget said, "And they're all dying." And there was just this pause, just kind of this acknowledgement. They're all dying. Mm-hmm. And we just paused. And then we started talking about what our week is going to be. And then we just moved on. And so this idea of this kind of acknowledgement of the beauty, the depth, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. No.
I was recently with one of my best friends in the world. She drove into Michigan from Nebraska to help me surprise my little brother for his 30th birthday. And she had a particularly bad night one night. She got divorced last summer from her wife and has been kind of spiraling and bouncing around since then. And she was losing it late one night and couldn't keep a grip and was just... I'm sure all of you have had experience where one thought is a slippery slope into all these terrible stories about yourself, and she was deep down that rabbit hole. And in the middle of all this ranting, we're sitting outside, it's dark, we're in a driveway, and there's one light shining on us, and then two cars. And from underneath the shadow of one car, this big, fat beetle walked, and both of us stopped, like in mid-sentence, both of us stopped and watched this epic journey of the beetle as it crawled. It was probably only like 3.5 feet from the shadow of one car to the shadow of the other car, and it stopped my friend and I dead, and she, after this epic journey of the beetle, she looks at me and she's like, "Did you fucking see that?" I was like, "That was the most epic journey I've ever seen in my life, from dark to light to dark. That beetle just lived a whole lifetime." And I don't know why, but that helped snap her out of it and started moving toward a different train of thought from her. It totally changed the tone and the tenor of our conversation. And it's the same as that leaf. It could be anything. I'm just really glad that both of us were there to watch this beetle go from one shadow to another shadow, and it changed our entire night.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mike?
So for me, one of the big questions of practice these days is being with a lot of sorrow. One of the things that I can tend to do in the midst of this pain is to start looking for the little leaf. And I shouldn't be feeling the way I'm feeling. Because goddamn, there's leaves everywhere. What's wrong with me? Um, So some of these stories, you know, some of the stories about, you know, people we lose and that kind of thing. I don't see a way out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you. You're pointing to something so important. It's subtle, the yearning to use Zen to fix the pain of our heart. That's not, at least, it's not what I understand Zen to be about. But we all have this in us that, oh, that sounds great. She saw a leaf, and they saw a beetle, and you know, that'll fix it. Where's the leaf? Where's the beetle? But of course, it's more like the part of the story of the people that I used to counsel, thinking that they would never stop crying.
Yeah.
That, if they... The trying not to cry was like an attempt to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
The opening to, there's no way out. Then there's no fixing. But things do have a life of their own. That's the weird reassurance. You know, and I almost started this talk. Last night I had a thought, but I didn't start this way, that in 100 years, we'll all be dead. You know, we'll be feeding, we'll be compost or ashes in the earth. Every single one of us and everyone we know. And we, there's no way out of that. There's no escape from that. That's just what's true. And if you try to escape, and we do try to escape, I mean, we do. And we use Zen as an escape, you know. We hear the story about people seeing peach blossoms and leaves and beetles, and we think, I'll look for that. And then we realize, no, that's not how it works. Every once in a while, there is this accident. But we can't look for it. We can't aim for it. We have to aim. Over and over and over again. Here, here, here. And then just see what happens. So it sounds depressing.
Mm-hmm.
But the mind will ruminate around it and make depressive thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to sort of let that go too. But this coming back to, what is it right now? What is it right here? Is beyond fixing. And it's beyond light and dark, you know, these infinite realms that we're walking through too. I bet the beetle didn't know. We don't know either. And we just have to keep where we are and not try to escape. But not be fooled. Right? It's so subtle, I just find to myself, my mind's going back and forth, back and forth. Not be fooled into thinking, and so it will be like this forever. Sure feels like that. And I know that a bunch of us in the room have been depressed, have had anxiety, have had great grief. It feels like it's going to be forever until it's not. That's the weird thing about it. So, and the last thing I'll say, I see a couple of other hands coming up. In the story, these people are not alone. Right? The two guys walking along from the condolence call, they're engaged in a relationship with each other about this great matter. And even though Daowu dies, Shixuang takes up the teaching again. It's not even personal. We're not alone in this. And right now, we're here together supporting each other in practice. And so, you know, if you find stuff's coming up for you during this weekend, you don't have to fix it. Nobody else has to fix it for you. And you can just go down, as Nat said. You can go down into the dark. And we'll all be here, sitting. That's the cool thing. For now, not in 100 years. So, Alan, is that your hand up?
Yes.
Okay, and who's over here?
Jeremy.
Okay, so Alan and Jeremy and Julie and Steve.
I just want to react to the Dharma dialogue by saying that what's coming up for me is, you know, sometimes when people find out I'm a Buddhist and they want to know about Zen Buddhism and they're from other religious traditions, which, you know, many of us originally are, they want to know, well, what does Buddhism have to say about death? And the implication of the question, and it's a serious question for them, and the implication is that, you know, that's what a religion, that's what a spiritual practice is for. That's the big problem to solve. And I think growing up, we think of death that way, you know, in a Judeo-Christian culture. Death is the big problem to be solved. And what I'm learning from this Dharma dialogue is that death, it's like you got this really difficult homework assignment, but it's actually going to write itself. You know, death is going to happen. But the real problem that Zen addresses is how to live. You know, and who wants an afterlife if you didn't have a life? You know, who wants eternal life if you were not living? You know, and not to, including not to let the inevitability of death be an excuse not to live. So I'm understanding this as an invitation.
Well, and this invitation of Zen, of course, is to go beyond all of our ideas. So this idea that in 100 years we won't be here, this idea of a leaf or a beetle, they're all distractions from this main issue of what is it? What is it? Yeah, thanks.
Jeremy?
I was wondering if you might say a little more about the power or the effects of saying, because one of the things that's happened for me over the course of my practice life is I have felt more and more acutely the inadequacy of my ability to express my own experience, and particularly, you know, like, there'll obviously be something going on. You know, you can look at me and you can see that I'm thinking about something or feeling something, not necessarily like completely mopey and brooding, but there's a thing happening in my head. And I can't explain it. And in fact, we'll very often have the experience like I'll start 5 or 6 times in a row and get 3 words in before I give up in total frustration, because I know that what I'm going to say is going to be so far from what's actually happening, such a vulgar reduction, and I can feel it as the words form in my mouth sometimes, that the idea and the experience is so clear and so vivid, and then when the words come to it, it's gone. And yet, there's also something that happens to be able to connect to another person through language. I believe powerfully in the importance, the power, the art of language and of expression, but there's this thing that happens when we say or we don't say.
Have you tried expressive dance?
No.
That's it. Sometimes when David and I are sharing the Dharma dialogue together, we'll look at each other, you know, just to make sure we each have room to say something. And I just looked at David, expecting
something wise.
But you know, Jeremy, I think you actually expressed it pretty well. And I'm not kidding. As you were talking, I was really trying to follow you, and I thought, wow, you are hitting the subtlety back and forth thing, point, 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 point. I don't know if there's more to add to it. I think I'll just underline what you said by saying sometimes it really is a way of reaching out to put words on it, and sometimes it totally diffuses it, and we just do our best with that. So, I mean, you just articulated it, and maybe later you'll be inarticulate. But for now, this is good.
And inhabiting that moment. So that moment of can't want to speak, can't speak, you know, that impossible stuckness. In Zen, we value that place where it is not working. Right? And we just want to, you know, what's the answer? So there is the place. Thank you. Julie?
During one of these morning sits, I felt a moment of appreciation for Zen practice in the way that just sitting releases us from the obligation to feel certain ways, particularly to feel happy, to feel energetic, to feel comforted, to, you know, it seems like there's a lot of expectation, or I have a lot of expectations of myself to be all of those things, and that I'm a failure if I'm not feeling happy, if I'm not feeling comforted, or not feeling like I can comfort, and there's something wrong with those other feelings. So I was feeling that, you know, appreciation of the freedom to not have to feel like the way I should. And then my mind being what it is, it turned around and said, well, yeah, Zen is about appreciation. And then, you know, but there are times you see that leaf, you see that beetle, you just can't appreciate it, and that's it too.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you.
So I was noticing, and I often notice, how I have this idealized notion of what it means to be open to the world right here and now, and that I go you know, searching for the leaf or the beetle or the flower, and when I'm not touched by that, when it doesn't step forward for me in that moment, I use that as a way to beat myself up about how, you know, I really should be here in this moment, you know, and I noticed that you know, my idealized notion of what it means to be here in this moment includes everything except how he actually is in this moment. It's this mental thing that I keep doing to myself, and it's the one thing that I can't actually, you know, accept. And it's, and you think even that you'd be able to, you know, figure out and do something about, but it shows up over and over. This, like David was saying, you know, this place of failing, you know, just being totally, oh, here I am again, stuck in this failure, you know, and this is the one thing that I don't want to have, you know? And yet that, you know, I find over and over again that's, you know, that's the only route is through, you know, what's actually here. I can be open to that, then there's the opportunity for, you know, to be open to other things to come forward. But first I got to be, you know, I got to be open to that failure, to that, my ideas of not being able to do this.
And let's just bring Julie's teaching onto that, right? That's it too. That we're constantly expressing the awakened nature. We can't help it. The assignment is writing itself. As Alan said. It's not just death, but being awake too, being a Buddha, already done. Check, get off your list. you don't have to do that. And yet the mind doesn't believe that, and keeps thinking. You know, and I think of those lines of Dogen that we love so much, where he talks about the difference between delusion and enlightenment, is that in delusion, you're going out towards the 10,000 things. Where's the flower? Where's the beetle? Oh, I'm going to get enlightened. I know I will. And the other is enlightenment. Practice enlightenment is this receiving. It's receiving. What's already here. It's already here. And it could come in the form of, I'm an idiot.
Steve. So it's really hard for the discursive mind. A friend of mine who doesn't speak English as a native speaker came across that word discursive the other day in a Dogen thing and was saying, what does this mean? Discursive. And it really is this tearing apart, you know, making things this and that. Is it alive or is it dead? Yeah, Chris and Raleigh and Kate.
So I was thinking as I was listening to the story of the Bale and the Leaf, these were really wonderful moments of, you know, brief periods of awakening. And, you know, this is it in that moment. But then David said they were distractions a few moments ago. And that really confused me. So I'm wondering what that was all about.
Your confusion?
Them being distractions.
I think that's only when you're doing interpretive dance.
Well, it's this, everything folds back in on itself. So if we think there's a leaf somewhere and we just have to find the leaf.
If we're in search of the leaf.
Right, that all of these teachings are false. Because they're not the thing itself. So all of these words were violating the precepts, were helping too much. So that's the danger, to think that there's something else. And if, oh, so now I get it. It's really beetles and leaves, right? Or whatever it is. Oh, now I get it. It's appreciation. Okay, great. You know, so anything we get is not it, which is why we have to give it all away and come back.
Yeah.
What's this? What's this? What's this? And the cost of entry into the moment is our opinion. Good opinion, bad opinion, it's all extra. And the invitation is not the leaf, not the beetle, not life, not death. Confusion.
So it's not about the beetle and the leaf, but it was about the beetle and the leaf.
Yes, apparently. But you know, even that, those are stories now. They're just memories in the mind. They're, you know, it's all in flux.
But Chris, I know you've had those moments where we can tell about it afterwards.
Yeah.
But it's what Jeremy was saying. You can talk about it, but the story you tell about your lovely experience yesterday is not your experience yesterday.
Right.
Yeah. And Zen is wonderful. I think there's a real appreciation of this language and, yes, the necessity and how do we point to it, and that we will get caught again and again in our stories. You know, how wonderful.
Yeah. You know, I love that line from Wu Men in his commentary on Mu, where he says, it's after you've had one of these leaf or beetle experiences, it's like you're a dumb person who's had a dream. Isn't that great? You know, that's how it feels like. Yeah. Dumb in the sense of not able to speak. But so wrong.
Yeah, it occurred to me, here's this family that's had this loss, and these two Zen masters, probably well-known teachers, come to pay a condolence call. And one starts knocking on the door. The other one, I don't know, I won't say. There is no answer. And that plays out right in front of the family.
Yeah.
Everybody, that this here is the central question, and
wow,
there's no answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never put that together. That's very powerful.
Yeah, this was their teaching. Huh?
Yeah.
Or the worst condolence call ever.
Yeah, I don't think they teach this in hospice.
Okay.
speak, I like to prefer to listen, but one of the things I want to comment on is the question in the koan, is it better to make a path for others or not? And that actually brought a tear to my eye, so I started looking inward as to why. And even if we make a path for someone, even if we are, I guess, selected to be a teacher, we can still not make a path for that person. They have to spend the time to make their own. And that I have become to light in the last 6 months of my own practice in my own home, where that makes me feel a very oppressive amount of sadness. Because no matter how much I study, no matter how much I watch and I learn and I listen, I'm never going to be able to follow another's path. I have to create my own, and then I can share my experiences. And I thought that that was a very powerful portion of that lecture this morning.
Thank you. I agree completely. Yeah.
Okay.
Second comment.
Yeah, it's related to that.
Yeah, no,
so
please.
Related. And on the inverse, you know, I can never give my path to anybody else.
Right.
And for me, that's actually really heartbreaking.
Yeah. Right.
It's like so heartbreaking.
You can't save people from their suffering.
Yeah.
And this, the deeper teaching that of thank goodness we can't.
Mm-hmm.
Like it seems so much like if only I could.
Yeah.
You know, give this to you, or you know, save you from, and this heartbreak, the wonderful heartbreak of the this manifestation of the Dharma, and having to trust. We have no other option, but that each person already on their own path.
I know I've talked about this before, but when I was a young clinician and was being trained to do psychotherapy, there was a kind of psychotherapeutic intervention where that I was trained in. And I thought it was so great because as a young person, I really wanted to help everybody and fix them and, you know, make sure that they all stop suffering.
Save the world, essentially.
Was that?
Save the world.
You saved the world. I really did, yeah. And I knew that at that point it was psychotherapy that was going to do it. Then it became other things. But it was called the miracle question. And I was supposed to ask my client, if you woke up tomorrow and a miracle had occurred, and things were just the way you wanted them to be, what would they be like? And it was great for working with people with depression and anxiety, and it was great for working with all kinds of things. And then I did this grief counseling training. And so first grief client comes in, and I said, so if a miracle occurred, I realized what I was saying.
Yeah.
Holy crap! Because I knew what I would say. And it came out of my mouth because it was my training, and the person just looked at me. Do I even have to tell you?
Mm-hmm.
and we cried together. And actually, that was the first time I ever did therapy with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
We just cried together. And it was like, there's no way out. There's no way out. And of course, things moved along. But at that moment, there was no miracle. And that was the miracle. Yeah, last comment, maybe.
There's a part in the reading where he talks about the, I think it's the way I remember it anyway, this foam from the waves going up into the, filling the clouds or the sky, right? Very vivid imagery for me. And what it makes me think of is the usefulness of this no way out. Because when I truly feel that no way out, it helps me choose what I want to do right now. You know, when I realize that the people, I'm overcome. Just talking about this, the emotion.
It helps me choose what is important in this moment. Instead of thinking about the future, about how I'm going to lose people I love, pick up the phone and call. Or sit down and write a quick email. Do the things I can do right now in this moment. And when I'm so busy with my life and not seeing the preciousness of right now, the gift that I have to be with people I love, I'm too busy to write that email. I'm too busy to make that phone call. I'm too, and so the gift of sort of being smacked in the face with there's no way out here, and you know no one makes it out alive, right? Is actually very useful and helpful for me. And I'm not saying that it doesn't hurt, because it does. I'm not saying I want it, because I don't. I'm just saying I find use in it. And I'm grateful for that. And that imagery brought up sort of the positive, for me anyway, the foam of the waves and the energy. There was just a lot of energy in that around living.
Yes.
Mm, yeah. Thank you, Laura. And thank you, everyone.